My guest at this time is author and historian James L. Swanson. He rose to fame several years ago with his book Manhunt, which chronicled the pursuit of John Wilkes Booth after the assassination of President Lincoln, but did so in the style of a riveting novel. His latest work is Chasing King's Killer, The Hunt for Martin Luther King Jr.'s Assassin. Not only is Monday a national holiday commemorating what would have been Dr. King's 89th birthday, but this coming April will mark 50 years since his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee, at the hands of James Earl Ray. For the next few moments, we'll discuss the assassination and its staggering impact on our nation. And James, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've done books on the Lincoln and JFK assassinations. So other than Dr. King not being a president, what strikes you as most different about the assassination of him compared to those other leaders?
Well, one thing is this. I think Martin Luther King is one of the bravest men in American history, in a way more so than Abraham Lincoln or John Kennedy, because unlike them, Dr. King was under constant threat of death and harassment for over 10 years. The FBI was hounding him and putting him under surveillance. J. Edgar Hoover's men wrote anonymous letters to King to try to get him to commit suicide. Hoover sent spies to infiltrate the inner circles of the civil rights leadership. And King himself was under danger. He was threatened countless times with death. His home was bombed. A gun was shot at his house. He was hit with bottles and rocks and stones. He was arrested over 30 times by white sheriffs and policemen, many of whom would have loved to have killed him when he was in the private custody of their cells. He was screamed at, shouted at by mobs, threatened constantly, and yet he persevered. In fact, in 1958, 10 years before he was murdered, a woman stabbed Martin Luther King in the heart at his first book signing in Harlem in New York City. And so that was the warning that he was living on borrowed time. You know, he could have gone back to private life and lived quietly as a husband, father, and minister to his local church. But he said, you know, for this great cause, we must all be prepared to die. In fact, when John Kennedy was assassinated, Martin Luther King turned to his wife and said, well, you know, that's what's going to happen to me. And so his bravery is so noteworthy. He overcame so many obstacles. He was so courageous. So that's one thing that makes him different from Kennedy and King. Not that they weren't brave, not that they weren't great men, but they weren't under the constant daily kind of threats that Martin Luther King had to face.
And he had a premonition not only in the wake of JFK's assassination, but the very day before his assassination. As you point out in the book, he gave a speech in Memphis on April 3rd, 1968, in which he said he's been to the mountaintop and he might not see the promised land, but he's seen it. So he definitely had an idea of what might be coming down, and probably because of the perpetual threats that had been going on for almost a decade.
Yes, he even said that night. He said, you know, I would like a long life, but tonight I'm not fearing any man. And he didn't know that just a couple miles away on that stormy night, that a man with a rifle was lying in wait in a hotel room, and he was going to come out the next day and hunt him down and kill him. It was really King's greatest speech, even better than the "I Have a Dream" speech. In fact, Ralph Abernathy, who was with him that night, said, "Of all the speeches I've seen him give, I never saw him better than he was on the last night of his life."
And an interesting little anecdote in the book is that King didn't even feel like speaking that night. He sent Abernathy to give the speech. And ultimately, when Abernathy saw the size of the crowd and the passion of the crowd, he said, "You've got to get over here." So that's
King wasn't feeling well. It was windy. It was stormy, heavy rains. He was tired. He didn't want to go out. And Ralph called him from the temple and said, you've got to come. There are a few thousand people here. Cameras are here. You must come. They want you." And King said, "All right, I'll come over." And he had no notes. He didn't have a written speech. And it was his last appearance was really his most magnificent one.
All right, let's talk about the details that led up to that now. As you point out in the book, in 1967, King is leading the civil rights movement, making a few political waves as well due to his opposition to the Vietnam War and some other things. James Earl Ray, at the same time, is escaping from the Missouri State Penitentiary. He then goes to Los Angeles and spends months doing what he does best, which is not being noticed and doing mundane things like taking dance lessons, going to bartending school. All of a sudden, then, in 1968, he picks up, goes back to the South, and hunts down one of the most famous people in the world. As you point out in the book, we still don't really know why, but based on all the evidence you've gone over, what's your best guess as to why all of a sudden he went from this guy who loved to live in the shadows to trying to kill Martin Luther King Jr.?
I think it's because he wanted to achieve some kind of significance or affect the world. Ray was a longtime, lifelong loser, grew up poor in Missouri, almost like Civil War type poverty, didn't even have shoes at school, dropped out of school, a lifelong petty criminal who came from a generation and forebears of criminals and grifters and chiselers. He was leading a nowhere life. And he had a chance. He escaped from prison in 67, as you say. And he didn't escape to hunt down Martin Luther King. He went to find a new life in California, like so many lost people in the 1960s did. And he had plastic surgery. In addition to the bartending and dancing, he took a locksmithing course. He went to see gurus and psychologists who would teach him self-awareness and self-improvement. It was an odd life. And then King flew to Los Angeles, where Ray was living, to give a speech. And when King left, Ray got in a Mustang, drove across America, and killed Martin Luther King 3 weeks later. Ray was certainly a racist, but he wasn't in the Klan. He never participated in racial violence. This hidden alarm clock, this hidden signal, went off in Ray, almost like he was a hibernating animal, that something triggered in him, and he decided to hunt down Martin Luther King. And I think he did it to achieve significance. Certainly, he wanted to send the civil rights movement into disarray, but I think his innermost motive was to be somebody, because he had been nothing for all of his life.
And as you document in the book, there's no real evidence to suggest conspiracy, whether his own explanation of some guy named Raul to other people thinking somebody paid him to do it. There's just no evidence that you've been able to discover, right?
No, there isn't. There is overwhelming evidence that it certainly was James Earl Ray in the window of the boarding house from which the shot was fired. There's so much evidence that it was certainly James Earl Ray, and James Earl Ray did it alone. I do believe there's some evidence that one or two of his brothers might have helped him plot it, or more likely, helped him during the initial phases of his escape. But after all these years, no evidence has ever emerged. Yes, there were rumors at the time that a rich, racist white man had offered a $50,000 or even $100,000 reward for the man who killed Martin Luther King. But how could have Ray found out who that man was? How could he have collected the reward? When Ray was finally captured after an amazing, thrilling two-month manhunt that went to England, Ray first pled guilty to avoid the death penalty, but then he changed his story, and he said a man named Raul had helped and guided him. Well, the story doesn't hold up. It's inconsistent. I think Raul was really one of Ray's brothers who was helping and guiding him along the way. But we'll never know that for sure, because Ray never confessed. Ray never told us what really happened, and his brothers never told us about their involvement. It's one of the frustrating mysteries of history, how one nobody, one man from the shadows, could take down one of the greatest men in history, and we don't know the full story of exactly what was in his mind.
We're talking with James L. Swanson. The book is Chasing King's Killer. And James, I don't know if this would have changed history at all, but I've read elsewhere that the Memphis police tried to shadow Dr. King and his entourage on that trip, but Dr. King and his entourage did not really trust the police and even at some points actively tried to lose their unwelcome chaperones. What do you know about that?
Yes, and in fact, a couple of policemen were assigned to keep an eye on Dr. King. Not so much to hound him or harass him, just to make sure the visit went safely, because this was Dr. King's third visit to Memphis in a short period of time to assist the striking sanitation workers in their cause for better working conditions and higher wages. And so a snowstorm had canceled one of the marches King wanted to lead. Another one had broken into violence because a group of young militants called the Invaders had made it a violent march, and that was a disaster. And so the Memphis police wanted to just make sure this was a safe, quiet visit. And in fact, two of them were in the fire station observing Dr. King's room from a distance at the Lorraine Motel. They saw him shot, and they yelled to each other, "Dr. King has just been shot." So they ran out of the fire station and ran to the Lorraine Motel to see what was going on. And unfortunately, Dr. King was standing alone on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, and he was the perfect target for James Earl Ray.
Obviously, this was, like you said, a two-month manhunt, and as a result of the high-profile nature of the case, the public was getting a little bit restless. What's your assessment? Most of the book obviously focuses on the FBI because they quickly took over the case, but what's your assessment of the Memphis Police Department in those very early hours of the case, as well as the FBI over the ensuing 2 months?
Well, regarding the FBI, though Hoover hated King, President Lyndon Johnson, Attorney General Ramsey Clark, ordered Hoover to take over the case. Hoover then launched a massive manhunt for James Lord Ray, first to identify him as the killer and then hunt him down. It was one of the finest hours in the history of the FBI. Half the FBI was deployed, a few thousand agents. Hoover knew that if he failed, the reputation of the Bureau would suffer and his own reputation would suffer. So Hoover gave it his all to hunt down James Earl Ray. And the FBI did a good job to identify him and track him down. The Memphis police were a bit in disarray right after the killing. Immediately after the shooting, Ray ran down the steps of his rooming house, ran into the street, and ran to his Mustang and drove off into the night. And the police might have done a better job ordering more roadblocks, alerting state police in the nearby states to seal off the roads leading out of the state. Ray took back roads and was headed for Atlanta, King's hometown. It was counterintuitive, but brilliant for Ray to drive to King's home city during his escape. And then the Memphis police were distracted because a teenager got on a ham radio and pretended to be someone in pursuing James Earl Ray in the Mustang. It was all a crank call, and it led some of the police on a wild goose chase for almost an hour. So that interfered with the proper reaction to the hunt for James Earl Ray. There was a chance to capture Ray before he escaped the city, but it was a brief window of opportunity, and the police didn't react quickly enough, and they were partly distracted by this false alarm spread by this malicious teenager.
Just 2 minutes left in our conversation, and I'm trying to get two very quick questions into this before we let you go. First of all, in the 1990s, I distinctly remember James Earl Ray insisting that he didn't do it, and he even got one of the King children to believe him, at least publicly. What was the deal with that?
Yes, it's a shocking photo. Some of the King children believe the U.S. government plotted the murder of Dr. King. Unfortunately, there's no evidence of that. One of the King sons went to visit James Earl Ray in prison and said, "I believe you, my family believes you, you didn't kill my father." It was one of the greatest con jobs by a lifelong con man, James Earl Ray. And there's a very disturbing photograph of King's son extending his hand to shake the hand of James Earl Ray. King keeps his hand in his pockets and stares at the son. And the look on Ray's face is, "Oh, you expect me to shake that black man's hand?" You can read it on his face. Unfortunately, James Earl Ray conned the King children. It was James Earl Ray. No evidence has ever proven otherwise.
And lastly, James, you mentioned in the beginning about the difference between what Martin Luther King faced and even what Abraham Lincoln and JFK faced. Talk a little bit, very briefly, about the appreciation you had for King in researching this book.
Well, the more I came to know him, the more I came to admire and respect him and love him. He was one of the great men of American history. He single-handedly put in motion great changes. You know, there were many important leaders in the civil rights movement, not to take away from them, but he was at the forefront of it all. And bravely, he persevered. His message today would be, keep going. He loved America. He didn't hate America. He thought America had failed to live up to its promise in the Declaration of Independence and Lincoln's life. And he wanted to carry on Abraham Lincoln's unfinished work and make America a better place. And so he would today say, "Where do we go from here?" which is one of the names titled to one of his books. What do we do today? Where do we go from here? So he should be a continuing source of inspiration.
James, we'll let you go. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
James L. Swanson, the book is Chasing King's Killer, The Hunt for Martin Luther King Jr.'s Assassin. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.